Today's episode of The Overwhelmed Brain is brought to you by GetOutOfTheMess.com. Real attorneys and real legal services, all for a very low monthly rate. Are you annoyed by affirmations? Are you even more annoyed when someone tries to tell you to
think positively? There's nothing to be upset about. Just close your eyes and pretend there's not a crisis happening right now. It's that easy.
Okay, thanks, Peter. I'll just keep...
Hey, get out of your car!
What are you doing?
Give me your damn car!
Somebody's trying to carjack me!
Just tell the thug that you're thinking positively, so he better watch out.
Your friend told you to think positively? You keep doing that, pal. Thanks for the car.
If affirmations feel like lies and positive thinking feels like a straight path to denial, then get ready to start creating the life you want now. Hello, this is Paul Coliani, personal empowerment coach and host of this show I call The Overwhelmed Brain, and this is the personal growth show for the critical thinker. On every episode, we'll talk about practical, down-to-earth steps to help you improve your mood and keep you sane in this powerful journey we call life. I want to help you bridge the gap between your emotions and reason, causing you to discover why you do the things you do and what you can do to reach higher levels of happiness and lower levels of stress and overwhelm. Everything I talk about on this show should not be mistaken for actual medical advice or treatment and is intended to be for informational and educational purposes only. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your medical treatment. What you will find here is an increase in your emotional intelligence, a strengthening of your self-worth and self-esteem, the motivation to be your authentic self, and the forward momentum to help you learn, heal, grow, and evolve. All right, I was talking to a client recently. We were on a Skype call, and actually, there's a funny side story here I want to tell you really quick. I have a mute button on my equipment. When I do my coaching through Skype, I press mute. I sometimes have to cough or sneeze or hiccup or make other noises, and because some of my clients want to record their sessions, I like to take those out and not include them in the conversation. So I will press the mute button on my audio equipment. Well, my last session, I did something like this. I was clearing my throat. I went, and it was louder than that. And my client stopped and he goes, wow. I was like, did you just hear that? And he said, yeah, you sounded like a cow. And I was like, I hit mute. I wasn't supposed to come through. Oh no. Have I been hitting mute all this time and it's not been working? Well, come to find out that it was actually muting my webcam mic, which I don't normally use. I normally use a studio mic for any Skype calls that I do. So that's neither here nor there. I just wanted to share something a little embarrassing. I'm fully transparent on this show. Actually, it was more than a little embarrassing. It was very embarrassing. Because this is something that we do when, you know, no one's watching or no one can hear us. And I'm used to pressing mute, so I didn't think anyone could hear. I didn't think he could hear that. And he did. So now I had to fess up. So I fessed up. We both laughed about it. He goes, you don't have to be embarrassed about that. I mean, of all things to be embarrassed about. I was like, I know. But I just thought, you know, you couldn't hear anything I was doing, so... It made me think, oh my God, what else did you hear? But it was funny and we had a good time. So my point with this story wasn't about that. It was about something that we talked about. And it had to do, I mean, we talked about a lot of things, but it had to do something that happened in his life when he was younger. And it gave me the idea of something, and I don't know if this is a term or not, and I'm just going to make up some terms. They may exist, they may not. Something that I called a spiritual correlation. And you could look at it as a philosophical correlation as well. But it's in the context of our session, I called it a spiritual correlation. You know, he has some spiritual beliefs. I have some spiritual beliefs. And having a belief outside of you can help you in certain things that feel hopeless, that seem like they're never going to end. If the pain is so great, then having a belief outside of you can help you. I don't normally get into that in this show, but I have it myself. And many of us do have some sort of spiritual belief or religious belief. And that's great, because sometimes we hope something's going to happen, and we just don't believe it's possible. So we seek guidance, we seek motivation, we seek things outside ourselves, just in case it's true. And of course, you may believe it's absolutely true. Some people will say there is absolutely a God, and this is why. Or there is karma, and this is why. And that's great. I am all about doing what serves you and believing what serves you. So when you are on your path, on your personal evolution, personal journey, and spiritual beliefs are on that path as well, great. Utilize them to the full effect. And don't listen to anyone, because spiritual and religious beliefs are yours and yours to keep and yours to keep you going. So when it works, keep utilizing those beliefs. And when they don't work, you may have to come up with new beliefs. This is what's great about beliefs, that you can believe anything you want as long as it keeps you, motivated, energized, or even hopeful. Hope can be a wonderful thing, and it can also be a damaging thing in some ways, which I've talked about in some shows, where hope keeps you stagnant. Like, I hope I win $10 million so I never have to work again. So I'm just going to buy my lottery tickets every week and stay at home and do nothing to invest in my future, hoping that I win millions so I can retire. I don't think that's a smart thing to do. It's possible it could be true. The chances are slim, but it is possible. But relying on that kind of hope keeps you stagnant. It keeps you in your place. It keeps you the same. And if it never happens, you don't typically go anywhere. And then you look back and you go, geez, I was hoping for all of those years and it never happened. I should have done something else. Or I should have done something in addition to hoping. And that is good. If you have some other thing that you can do while you're hoping, for example, maybe someday I'll appear on, I was going to say Oprah, but maybe Ellen. I don't think Oprah's on the air anymore. So maybe I'll appear on the Ellen show. That would be a nice thing, but I'm not going to sit back and hope it happens. I'm just going to keep showing up in the world. I'm going to keep showing up on the air. I'm going to keep showing up online and doing what I do. Sure, it would be nice, but I'm not going to wait for it to happen. I'm going to keep pushing forward as if it will never happen. And that's a good place to stick hope. You can hope something happens, but push forward knowing it will never happen. And there's a quote around knowing, because you don't know, you just make it a belief so that you can push forward. Because if you have too much hope, it might prevent you from pushing forward. Pushing forward is full acceptance that what you hope for won't ever come to exist. That's kind of a yucky thought. But if you push forward in that way, then you'll achieve a lot more than sitting at home waiting for your lottery numbers to be chosen. My mom does that. I do it on occasion. We're out and about and I'll go to the store and buy a lottery ticket, knowing that I just donated to the state's education system, not really giving me a chance to actually win. But hey, I might, but I probably won't. And it's rare. Once every 6 months, I'll buy something. And it's usually my girlfriend going, let's buy a ticket. And I'll go, okay, that sounds like fun. But let me get back to this spiritual correlation or philosophical correlation, whatever you feel comfortable calling it. The correlation that you make between today, something that's happening in your life today, and something in the past that you feel either regret for or guilt about or shame or embarrassment or any of a number of nasty feeling emotions that a lot of us tend to carry on longer than necessary. Is there something you did in your past that you regret or wish you had done differently? I know there is for me. And what I mean by spiritual or philosophical correlation, I'll just call it spiritual correlation from this point on, too many words, is that there's a lesson to be learned by the regrets and shame and embarrassment and other nasty feelings from your past. There's lessons to be learned from those moments. And we can either continue to learn those lessons over and over again by continuing the suffering, or we can let go of what happened and take the lessons with us so that that kind of thing, we do our best to never let it happen again. So the spiritual correlation is look at what's happening in your life today and how does it relate to what happened in the past that you feel any of those nasty feeling emotions about. For example, let's just say that something isn't going right in your life today. Something is off or needs improvement or needs a total overhaul. If you have something in mind, I want you to think about something that happened in your past that might be related in some way. And when you come up with something in your past, I'm going to give you a little exercise that you can do to find any type of spiritual significance or correlation to what happened in the past and today. It's like connecting the dots between the present and the past, or what I like to think of as completing a circuit. I don't know how much you know about electricity, but when you plug a lamp into a wall, you are completing a circuit. The circuit ends at the wall, and then you extend that circuit into a light bulb. I mean, this is probably oversimplifying it a lot, but let's just say that it closes the circuit so that the light bulb can get powered, can get electricity. Great. You've connected two dots, the power source and the thing that needs power. I call that closing the circuit or completing the circuit. And you can do this in your mind too. Something happening today in your life is, let's just say, the light bulb. And something happening in the past is the circuit. So how can we correlate the light bulb with the circuit and make that light shine so we have a new thought, pun intended, and find the spiritual correlation and figure out what lessons we can learn and maybe what we can release and express from that past event? I mean, I'm sure some things come to mind right away. Well, if that thing in the past never happened, then what's happening to me today would never happen. You might already have those correlations. So we're going to have a little exercise right now that will help you get through something in the past, and especially something that deals with, like I said, regret, guilt, shame, embarrassment, and other nasty feeling emotions. We don't want to carry those around. So let's do this. Get something in mind. Get something that you feel ashamed or embarrassed or regret or guilt about. And when you have it in mind, if you don't, just pause and when you're ready, come on back. But when you have it in mind, what I want you to do is the following. First, just come up with a memory. Remember what happened. It may not be pleasant, especially if you're carrying any of those unwanted emotions. But just remember what happened. Great. You have a memory of it. And now what? What do I do with it? So here we go. We're going to use some visualization. You can probably come up with this, even if you're not an adept visualizer. What I want you to do is create a record keeper in your mind. And for example, mine would be sort of like, I don't know if you've ever seen those 50s and 60s television shows that are in black and white, and there's a secretary on a dictation machine, and she's taking notes. And this record keeper is going to take notes for you. And he or she or it is going to just note the facts. That's all this record keeper does, is just record the facts. And it's going to be the facts about this memory. And this will make sense in a minute. So once you create this record keeper, I already told you what mine looks like. It's like a secretary and very conservatively dressed, taking notes for the boss on a TV show. Whatever yours is, remember, he or she or it is going to only record facts, not emotions. So if you do feel emotions come up while you're remembering this event in your life, that's all right. We're doing this process to allow access to a place that contains a lot of emotional energy. So there might be emotions repressed in that memory that need to be released. So accessing them is a good first step. So just allow them to come if they come. And if you feel emotional, remember, you've got your record keeper there, and they're going to take notes here. But we may have to go through some pain or hurt or regret or other things that might come up. But don't worry about it. They're going to pass shortly, and I'm not going to leave you in this space. So now, thinking about this event in your past, I want you to tell the record keeper to record what needs to be learned here. Again, you're not asking them about the emotions, and you don't want them to judge what's going on. All they're doing is looking for the facts. For example, I think about a time in my past where I purposefully made it look like my little brother broke one of our father's rare glass figurines. He had alcohol. It was like a little, they call them like alcohol nips, I think. They're like mini bottles of alcohol, but some of them are rare. Some of them are unique. Like this one was shaped like a glass penguin. It was really cool. I think it had a green liquid in it. And I don't even know if you could open it. I think it was just filled with some sort of green liquid, but it was part of his, quote, nip collection. Well, anyway, as a kid, I broke it. It was sitting in the bathroom on the bathroom sink, and I knocked it over, and one of the arms broke off. And boy, did I feel scared and bad, but mostly scared, mostly like, oh no, this is bad. This is bad news. This is his favorite nip, and I'm going to get in trouble. But, as I said, I purposefully made it look like my brother broke it. And that event made me feel regret, because he got in so much trouble. And no matter how much he denied doing it, I kept hearing my dad say, I know you did it, so don't lie to me. I feel bad about that. I don't carry the regret like I used to because of this exercise and other ways I've healed from that, but I still feel bad about it. I still wish I had done that differently. So when I think about this process, when I think about a memory that I regret, that is definitely one, because I allowed it to happen. I've since apologized to my brother about that, but at the time, you know, he was a child. I was his big brother. He was supposed to be able to look up to me, and I got him in trouble. So I had to move through that and heal from some of my regret. But anyway, you go to your record keeper and you ask them to take notes on the facts of the memory, the facts of the situation, the facts of that event. Here's what I came up with for my event, and this will help you maybe organize your thoughts around the facts of your event. One fact is that I wanted to avoid getting in trouble. That's a fact. That's true. The record keeper is not here to judge that or talk about emotions. They just want the facts. So my record keeper, she notes, okay, you wanted to avoid getting into trouble. Great. Fact one. What's another fact? Okay, another fact is I intended for my brother to get into trouble instead. Unfortunately, that's also true. Okay, that's just a fact. Now, while you're doing this, some emotions might come up. You might cry. You might have something pop up that you didn't think of before, but you're just going over the facts, and it's okay if these emotions come up, let them arise. And if you have to express them or release them or just let them come up and do what you have to do, let them be, because you don't want to resist them. Just let them be. But then come back to the facts. Okay, the next fact is, like I said, I intended for my brother to get into trouble. That's true. What's another one? Another one is that I knew the figurine meant a lot to my dad. That hurts, but it's true. That hurts because I broke it, and I think about the other things around this event, and especially that I got my brother in trouble, but it's true. It's just a fact. I knew the figurine meant a lot to him. All right, what's another one? Another one is that it took place in the bathroom. Okay, that's true. It's probably insignificant, but these are just facts. Okay, so what else? I pulled up a chair to the sink and left it there so that our father would find it and make the assumption that I was trying to make him have. Ouch. There's a big fact. It's premeditated, and wow. So, but it's just a fact. Like I said, today I don't have too many emotions regarding this event because I did some healing and some apologizing over it. Today it's just a fact. But what we're looking for in one of your events is if you are still affected by it today. Okay, so let's just say that I am affected by that today. I pulled up a chair and left it next to the sink so that our father would find it and make the assumption. There's a fact. The next one is I didn't speak up and tell the truth when my brother was getting yelled at. True. My father was very upset. That's true. And then my record keeper asked, can you think of anything else? And I go, okay. It was daytime. Okay, that's mundane. It may or may not mean anything, but what else? I left the door open. Okay, and I could go on with a billion facts, but I think I got the major ones. Just the ones about the actual incident that led to my feelings about it. I think I got all those major facts laid out. So the next step in this process, in your mind, is to bring in someone wise. Someone you trust. Could be a real person, could be a fictional character, could be an animal, whatever you imagine to be wise. Like a wise owl. Or somebody or something. Remember, this is your imagination. You can make it anything you want. You just want to be able to communicate with whomever you bring in. So this person, we'll call him, her, or it your guide, will be the one that looks at all the facts that you just, you know, had your record keeper write down or you wrote down yourself as you went through this process. And this wise person is going to ask you questions. You know, wise people, they ask questions. Yeah, they also give answers, but they also ask questions to help you get to an answer that will benefit you in some way. So the first question that this guide is going to ask you is, can you get beyond the suffering of this event? Now think about that. Can you get beyond the suffering of that event? Can you do it? You may answer yes, you may answer no, you may answer, I want to try, or maybe, or I don't know. But whatever it is, I just want to have that guide plant that seed, that question. Because, you know, what comes up for you when you answer that? And it doesn't really matter what the answer is. We're just throwing it out there. But let's just say that the answer is anything but yes. So this is where your guide will ask you questions based on the facts. For example, in my case, fact number one is that I wanted to avoid getting into trouble. My guide's question is, do you still do that type of behavior today? Which behavior is that? Well, do I avoid getting into trouble today? And my answer is no, because if I do something that I know that I caused, if I do something that I know will hurt someone else, I'm going to fess up. I'm going to admit it. So my answer to that question is no, I don't do that behavior today. And the guide goes, okay, let's go to the next question. So whatever it is for you, whatever your first fact is, and the question might be something like that. It may not always work out that way, but we'll get to that in a second. So fact number two in this case is that I wanted my brother to get into trouble. So my guide will ask me, do you still do that behavior today? And I'll go, well, I'm not near my brother. I don't live with my brother. So no. And then my guide might say, well, do you do that with anyone? Do you want other people to get into trouble? And I think about that and I go, no, I don't want that to happen. It is not my intention or my purpose to get someone else in trouble. Okay, let's go to the next question. And you're going through your own facts here. And your guide is asking you similar questions. Do you still do that behavior today? So fact three in my case is that the figurine meant a lot to my dad. It's a fact. My guide probably won't ask me about behavior from this fact. But, you know, being the all-knowing wise teacher they are, they'll probably ask me something about meaning and value to others. Does that make sense? Like, the figurine meant a lot to my dad. So I can picture my guide asking, well, do you honor the valuables of others? And I'll go, ooh. When I think about that question, something does come up for me. I think about my girlfriend. When I moved into her place a couple years ago, she told me about her dishes. And she said, be very careful with those dishes. Make sure they're not touching in the dishwasher and make sure you don't break any of them. I mean, she didn't sound that assertive, but she was like, just make sure you don't break anything. And I was like, of course. I mean, my intention's not to break anything. So I would use her plates and her dishes and wash them and put them away. And if she heard them clink against one another really loud, she would look at me and she would say, don't break those. Don't chip them. And I was like, wow, she's really sensitive about these dishes. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm just going to buy her another one. If I break it, I'll buy her another one. But what that did is take me out of valuing what those dishes meant to her, because I thought she was being overly sensitive, or, you know, wherever I went with that. But when I took myself out of honoring what she found valuable to her, when I took myself out of it, I became insensitive. So when I think about what my guide asked me, do you honor the valuables of others? My first answer is, of course I do. But then I think about what's happening in my life today, handling her dishes, and I ask myself, well, could I treat those with more care? Could I treat those as if those were the only ones ever made? And my answer is yes, I could. I could treat them with more care. Does that mean I feel like I'm living in fear and walking on eggshells around her? No, I just really care about her caring about those dishes and plates. So I will treat them with more care. Now, she did that with every single thing that she bought. It might be a little different, and I'd be like, hey, you know what? I feel like I'm walking on eggshells around here. But she really cares about these plates. And there's a good reason why, because I found out later, that's one gift that she bought for herself when she finally got out of an abusive relationship. It was a gift to herself. And suddenly those plates had more meaning to me as well. And I was like, wow. It wasn't some crazy, overly sensitive thing about material items. This meant a lot to her. So this helped me correlate a spiritual significance, something in the present to something in the past. Now, it might have been her past correlating it for her. And that can happen during this process because you start to feel empathy for someone else, or sympathy, or some sort of relative feeling for someone else as you go through it yourself. It can happen. My focus on this process is for you, so that when you, your guide, or yourself, if you don't want to call it your guide, you're just asking yourself questions, doesn't matter. When you get questions like, are you still doing this behavior? Do you honor people because you didn't honor someone back then? You know, those kinds of questions, good to know. It's good to find this stuff out about yourself. You may or may not have a problem today, but you get the idea of where this can lead. So let me get back to these questions and see if I can finish this process up here. Fact number 4 in my example is that it took place in the bathroom. So my guide might ask me if the bathroom has any significance or meaning. He or she might ask if bathrooms in general are a trigger for me. My answer, no. The fact that it happened in the bathroom is completely meaningless to me. I have no emotion attached to bathrooms. It's a good question, though, because you never know. You might have an aversion because something happened to you in a certain room in your house when you were younger. So that could be a circuit that gets completed when you start asking yourself these questions, or your guide does. All right, 2 more facts. Fact number 5 is that I pulled up a chair right next to the sink and left it there so that my father would believe that my little brother, who couldn't reach it, put the chair up to climb it to reach for it. That is so manipulative. That is so tricky. That is so premeditated and just plain mean. But I did it. And so I am fessing up to it on the air even, but I'm fessing up to it in my mind too. I'm like, all right, that's a fact. I pulled up a chair, left it next to the sink, so my father would think that he went for it and broke it. Now at this point, my guide knows what to ask for sure. He asks, do you still influence or try to manipulate people's thoughts so that they make the assumptions you want them to make? Now I have to think about that. Am I always 100% ethical and moral? I mean, I try to be, but do I ever influence or try to manipulate other people's thoughts? You know, I think about my personal life. I think about my friendships. I think about my online interactions. Is this true? Do I still try to influence or manipulate people's thoughts? So that's something I might want to explore. If I'm trying to paint a picture for someone else to get them to a certain conclusion or to get them to a certain thought process, then I might be holding on to something from the past. And if I'm holding on to something from the past, guess what? That's going to continue any suffering that I might have from the past because I'm repeating the behavior. When you repeat the behavior, you might repeat the regret or I should say extend the regret, extend the shame, extend the embarrassment, extend the guilt, all those not so good feelings, because you might be repeating the behavior in a different way. So I may have to look at that. And if I can't really think of a time when I do that now, from this point forward, I will think about it. Am I writing this post to manipulate people or to make them assume things that I want them to assume? Am I putting thoughts in their head that I want them to do without really being direct about it? I mean, I don't have a problem when someone's direct. Like, try this. And this is why you should try this. But if I'm purposefully manipulating someone's thought process, then that might fall in line with what I did in the past. So that's something I'll definitely be aware of, or at least more aware of, because going through this exercise, like real time, right now, I think about this stuff. Am I always 100% honest and authentic every single second of the day with every person I ever meet? That's a good question. Are you? So let's get to fact number six. Fact six is that I did not speak up and tell the truth when my brother was getting yelled at. You know what my wise, all-knowing guide will ask, right? Do you find yourself not speaking up and telling the truth when others are in trouble? That's a good question. And I can say, I believe I do, most if not all the time. And I've talked about this before. I spoke up once for a coworker that wasn't in the office because my two bosses were talking down about him. So I spoke up. I feel like, wow, I've done that, so I know I'm capable of doing it, and I know that I can choose to do it, and I know that when I feel it's the right thing to do, that I will do it. So I feel pretty confident about that. If something happens in the future, am I going to do it? I don't know. I think I have to assess every situation as it comes, but I feel pretty confident that I would do that. Now, my inner guide can also pinpoint it even further and take out a piece of information. Instead of saying, do you speak up and tell the truth for others, they might just say, do you speak up and tell the truth? Well, I typically do speak up and I typically do tell the truth, but I'll be aware of that as I go forward. Do I need to speak up? But in this exercise, what I want you to do is keep your questions to yourself or your guide's questions to you really focused on the event and the exact facts about that event, so that any lessons that you can learn from that event won't get muddled into generalizations. Like you're just generalizing. Do you always tell the truth? I would rather have you not generalize and just say, do you tell the truth for others? Or whatever it is for you. For me, it was, I didn't tell the truth for my brother. Do you tell the truth for your brother? Well, that's very specific, but I can generalize it a little bit. Do you tell the truth for others? Do you tell the truth for family? I can just apply it as close as I can to relate to that event. You'll end up generalizing a lot of things anyway, and that's okay. Generalizing to do good things and do good behavior in life is a good thing. So it's not a problem if that happens, and if that's where you need to go with it, great, no problem. So where am I going with all this? The whole point of this process is garnering the lessons from the event in your life. And sometimes it's hard to learn the lessons because you're so embroiled in the emotions from the event. And it can be a huge challenge to step out of those emotions and into some sort of data gathering process, which is what we did here. So sometimes we need to call in a guide or some help. Like I had a record keeper and a guide. It's silly. I mean, I think it's a little silly, but it's an exercise to give you some resources because you may not be able to do this just by thinking about the event all by yourself, all with your own brain. Even though the whole thing is taking place in your brain, having a perspective come in that is a record keeper that gathers the facts and is someone with wisdom, or even someone else that you can bring in that can be there to support you and comfort you while you go through this process. It's your mind, so you can bring in any resource you want. And then you get to a place that once you garner the lessons, you typically learn what you needed to learn at that time in your life. The spiritual correlation between what happened then and what's happening in your life today, those two points connect and complete a circuit and many times neutralize some of the stuff that you don't want happening in your life today. It's hard to explain. The best way to go through this is just to go through it and find out how it works for you and find out what happens for you. Because you might learn that the way you used to behave then might be the same way you behave now, but maybe in like little smaller instances. And if that's the case, if your behavior is being repeated today, then that's where some self-growth needs to take place. Because doing those old behaviors may be causing you to hold on to some old repressed emotions. And then when you learn and grow from events like that, you carry into the future the ability to change old behavior, which leads to diminishing negative emotions. And then you can take that ability into the future and choose to use it or not. Because when you learn lessons but don't apply them, and I'll go out on a limb here, it keeps your suffering about the event alive. Now, there's a lot more that a person does to hold on to suffering, but when you still do behavior that led you down a bad path before, you may have trouble letting go of the pain, the shame, the guilt, the regret, or whatever else you're carrying with you. Yes, there are things that you've done in your past that you may never be able to repair. But what do you do today that isn't what you did then? And what can you do differently that isn't what you did then? These are kind of tricky, deep questions, but that's what makes the difference going forward and helps you dissolve the suffering. And you can connect these two points, the past and the present, and make some sort of spiritual or philosophical correlation, then you might complete the circuit and dissolve or diminish the negative emotions about the event and other things. Because sometimes when you diminish negative emotions about one event, it can diminish the negative emotions about other events that were related. Like if you were angry or you felt shame, it can diminish shame and anger from other events in your life too, just by doing it with one event. It gets technical, but I hope you're able to follow along. I mean, this whole process is to help you get beyond some things that might be going on in your life today. So I hope it works for you. If you go through it and you have some success, you know, let me know. But just remember, when you're going through it, just get the facts and ask the non-judgmental questions about behavior and other things that come to mind, but just fact-based, because you're collecting data. And you may also want to ask yourself questions if you have the same beliefs or the same values or the same personal boundaries that you did then. Ask yourself a bunch of questions, but keep them focused on that one event. That way you can come closer to a resolution of that single event. I mean, you can always do the same process for other events in your life too, but keep this process focused on that single event and see where it takes you. Thanks for playing along. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Today's episode is brought to you by GetOutOfTheMess.com. If you don't know what that is, you probably haven't heard too many episodes of this show because for a while there, Asha would come on the air. She's a representative for Legal Shield, and you can go through her to get legal representation or legal help, all for a low monthly fee. And yeah, I know the first thing you think of is, oh, another monthly payment. And I totally get that, but you got to think about what you're getting for this monthly payment. If you have ever hired an attorney, you know that it can be quite an enormous bill just for 1 hour at maybe $250, for example, for 1 hour. And you also know that you typically don't hire an attorney for an hour. It's usually multiple hours and the bill just keeps racking up and racking up. So typically, you know, we try to reserve calling an attorney until it's absolutely necessary. And one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that there are services available that you can call an attorney for anything for this low monthly subscription and not pay the $250 an hour for many of the services they offer. For example, when someone tried to sue Asha for using illegal images on her website, which she didn't know about because her web designer put them there, she called her attorney, which she only pays for $20 a month for access to her attorney. And they sent the company a letter and said, you know, it's not her fault. And it was the web designer and they have been removed and they never bothered her again. But had she not had this option, she would have had to go through a big mess, which is why she created getoutofthemess.com. So if you are having any trouble anywhere and you just want to get out of that trouble, because if it's holding you up, if it's holding you back, if it's always on your mind and it's always stressing you, why not pay like $20 a month to have access to attorneys that can do some representation for you? You can't imagine the number of things that you can use an attorney for until you have full access all the time. It's quite a liberating feeling. I mean, just having the ability to send my book contract to an attorney without having to pay them hours for their work because contracts are included in the monthly subscription fee, I'm thrilled. So I use this service. I recommend that you use this service, and I want you to give Asha a call at 678-355-8777 or go to getoutofthemess.com and check this out because it can help you with so many things. You don't have to wait for just the big things to use an attorney. You can use them almost any time. So call Asha today and find out if this service is right for you. 678-355-8777. All right, this segment's called Ask Paul. This is where I read a listener email on the air and do my best to help them through a challenge or two. And some of these emails that I read, I will read in the patron program and answer them there and just send the person who wrote it a direct link to the episode so that they have the answer and the patron members have the answer too, because I just can't fill this show with all the emails that I get regarding all the subjects. So if you're interested in hearing the messages that I don't read on the air, or you want to hear the other private episodes or get some private worksheets, go to patron.theoverwhelmedbrain.com and you can hear those. But let's get to this message from someone I will call Jill. Jill writes, "Thank you for reading my email." That's a great start, Jill. Thank you. She says, "I love your commitment to being so responsive to those who reach out to you for help." And now I have to acquiesce and say, oh, 3 months isn't that responsive. But here I am. I'm reading your message, Jill. I stumbled upon your podcast about 6 months ago, and it has truly helped me deal with my anxiety and self-worth issues. So here is my current issue. I come from a family where addiction runs very strong. My mother is a severe alcoholic and prescription drug user. My father was on hard drugs and drank when I was younger, but has been sober since early 2000. I am the oldest child, and I have had some issues with alcohol that has led me to abstaining most of the time. However, I do have the occasional glass of champagne at celebrations. My brother has never touched drugs or alcohol and has not had any issues. Another one of my brothers is going down a path of destruction and has multiple DUIs and is currently addicted to heroin. My other brother and mother live at home with my father, who is sober, and it is clear that they take advantage of him. My father makes decent money, but neither my brother or mother create any source of income. It's a very volatile situation, and when I speak to my father, he is very unhappy, but is afraid to leave because it is obvious neither my mom or brother can survive without him. When he brings it up to me, I tell him he needs to do the right thing for him, and no one will blame him for leaving the situation. But I also understand how guilty he'll feel. He grew up with an alcoholic mother, and I think it is what he is comfortable with, and he has also become a textbook enabler. I want to help him leave the situation and be happy, but I'm also terrified what will happen to my mom and brother. At what point do you stop being responsible for your family members? At what point is it okay to walk away and let someone else hit rock bottom? I've since moved 2 states away and rarely communicate with my brothers or mom, but I talk to my dad regularly and I can tell how helpless he feels. I remember feeling that way when I lived at home and it took me years to heal. I still feel guilty sometimes for walking away, but I don't think there was anything I could do to help them. Since I've left home, I've spent a lot of time working on myself through therapy, reading books, podcasts, and just taking care of myself. I have a pretty happy and fulfilled life, and I want my dad to have that too. Thanks for listening." Thank you, Jill. Thank you for sharing that very personal stuff and those challenges. And, you described a lot of my upbringing. Unfortunately, that is the case when you have alcohol and drugs in the mix of family. You're going to have family members that go straight sober and don't want anything to do with alcohol and drugs. That was kind of my path. And then you're going to have family members that go all the way. They want to medicate and not deal with their emotions. So they put drugs or alcohol in their system, and that's what they use to medicate and to repress those emotions. I have two or three family members like that, at least three, at least three family members like that. And then you have the middle of the road ones that take some drugs. And I mean, that's a very common theme amongst families that have some sort of person in authority, some person in a lead role that people have to listen to. They're also the person that does the drugs, does the alcohol, and then it just kind of bleeds down from there. And, you know, drugs and alcohol are one of those things that they can be used recreationally and people have no problems with them, and then they can be abused. And when they're abused, dysfunction usually occurs. I mean, dysfunction can occur no matter what, with or without drugs. But typically when drugs and alcohol are abused, you find, you know, sometimes major dysfunction. And what do you do with that? Well, what you did was get out. And that's smart. You get out of the situation, because sometimes the entire family runs on the dynamic and centerpiece of the biggest addict or the biggest abuser or biggest influencer. So everyone acts in relation to how the biggest influencer acts. And that means everyone else is reacting. So sometimes to get out of that, you have to get out of that. That's what I did when I actually left home probably a couple years later than most. I left home when I was 20. But since then, I've only been back once to live anywhere near my family. And it's not because I don't love my family. It's because I wanted to get out of a dysfunctional household and live my own life. But certainly one of the motivations to leave that place was a particular family member. It wasn't the only motivation, but I used that as sort of the impetus for me to get off my butt and do something with my life. So that's what I did. But then after I learned about my own dysfunctions and my own unhelpful beliefs about the world and about people and about myself, I started to realize, oh, when I was in that situation, I didn't realize my stepfather was so influential in all the decisions I made for my life and all the decisions that almost every member of my family made for their lives too. And you know what? The crap just rolled downhill from my stepfather to my mom, to the kids, to me, and probably even to the grandkids. Hopefully it doesn't. And hopefully all my siblings who are parents now can protect their children from the negative influence that we went through. But, you know, dysfunction is somewhat passed down sometimes and just creates a new dynamic for the entire family. So anyway, let's get to your question. I totally get where you're coming from. And one of your questions is this: at what point do you stop being responsible for your family members? Well, here's what you do. The day the question comes in your mind, at what point do I stop being responsible for my family members? The day that question comes to mind is the day you do it. It's as simple as that. I mean, specifically, you are not responsible for your family members. In fact, if you take responsibility, you'll become an enabler, just like you said your dad was. The enabler cleans up after people's messes, tries to fix their life. I mean, it's all noble, and it comes from a place of probably being overly compassionate, like trying to help the other person because you love them. You can still love people, and by loving them, sometimes you have to let them be dysfunctional. And by letting them be dysfunctional, they learn on their own, in their own time, when they need to do something about their life. And the hardest part to accept is that some people may never learn. That's very hard, especially for me, who loves to help everyone I meet, but can't. It's true. I can't help every person I meet, because some people don't want it. Some people aren't ready for it. Some people maybe don't trust me. It doesn't happen often. But it does happen, because they're in a space that they don't want to meet me at. They don't want to meet me in my world. They want me to meet them in their world. And that's true for almost everyone, really. Meet me where I am. So when you talk to your father, you meet him where he is. And he's like, I don't like where I am. Okay. So you meet him there. And dad, do you want to change? Yes, I want to change. Okay. Are you going to change? No, I'm not ready. Okay. If you're not ready, then I'm with you. I'll be here when you are. You're meeting them where they are. And you're also giving them the space to make their own decision. Because that's self-empowering. That's a gift. When you give someone the space to make their own decision, that's the gift of empowerment that you can give to your father. That gift is the best gift you can give to someone, even when you think their life is going in a downward spiral. Because have you ever tried to help someone that wasn't ready for it, or didn't want it, or listened but didn't make any changes, and they stayed the way they are? And most of the time, they stay who they are until they reach that rock bottom, which is your second question. At what point is it okay to walk away and let someone else hit rock bottom? Now, this is controversial. I'm going to tell you things that may not work for you, but in my life, I have to let someone hit rock bottom, and that's a huge risk. And I'm talking about my personal life, my family life. I have a relative that takes a lot of drugs, and I am watching this person spiral down and basically kill themselves with drugs. And it's hard because this person is close to me. But what do you do? I mean, you can do an intervention, I guess, and that can work. I've seen TV shows where it works. I don't know if it always works. I don't know what the success rate is. I'm not typically the intervention type guy. Because I think we all do the best we can with the resources that we have. And because change typically works when it's self-initiated. I'm not against interventions. They probably can and do work, but they may not. I just don't follow that path. I just meet them where they are. And I show them love and compassion and kindness and respect. And this leads to another point, which is the best way to help someone who's in this situation, and this is my own opinion, is be the best and healthiest person you can be so that when they are ready for a change, you are the person that if they reach out to you and ask for help, you can help them with that change. It's hard to help someone with change when you are influenced by that someone or part of the family dynamic that is influenced, and you've moved yourself out of that family dynamic from what I can tell in your letter. You know, going through therapy and reading books and taking care of yourself. The better and healthier you are, the more that will rub off on others. It doesn't mean you go around saying, I'm better and healthier. You just live it. You show up as that. And you do it with compassion and loving and kindness so that they feel good with you. They may not feel good with you, but they're safe to be around you being themselves. Because that's huge. I mean, a lot of people will take drugs and drink a lot of alcohol because they're afraid. There is some sort of fear, whether it's a fear of past pains or future things that give them anxiety, or just afraid of what's going on inside of them for other reasons. But imagine if they were with someone where they weren't judged and they were loved and respected for exactly who they are, no matter what they did. That's a different feeling than being around someone who says, you should get out of that situation. You should stop taking drugs. You should do this. You should do that. That's a different vibe, and it can often exacerbate their behavior. I can't tell you how many times I told my mom to leave my stepfather. And, you know, this is 20 years ago. I just said, why don't you leave him? Come live with us. We'll help you. We'll move you out. We'll go in and get your stuff. We'll do everything we can to help you out. And she never did, and she never could. She had her own fears, she had her own reasons, and she wasn't ready until she was ready, and that took another 20 years. And I felt where you are. I didn't want her to hit rock bottom. I didn't want her to be in that situation. I just saw that situation as dangerous, abusive, and of course, highly dysfunctional, and she was definitely enabling him to continue being who he was. And no matter how hard she tried, it just got worse and worse and worse. And no matter how hard the family tried to get her away from him, it never improved. In fact, even mentioning that she should leave him probably brought up more fears in her, causing her to go into more denial. I mean, you never know what's going to happen. So all you can do is be kind and non-judgmental and healthy to A, be a role model, and B, be the healthy person that they know they can trust and rely on when the time comes that they make a decision to improve their situation. That's all you can do. Sometimes you do have to let them hit rock bottom, because breakthroughs come from the breakdown. When someone has a breakdown, it might be the first time they realize they have a choice. When you're in it, you may not realize you have a choice. So you don't even consider any choices. You don't consider any alternatives to your situation. But when the breakdown comes, sometimes all hope is lost and you realize, wow, I've got nothing else to lose. I can do this instead. And then they get out of the situation. Or it could be worse. Their breakdown could be injury or death. It can go that route. I mean, if you see a serious situation where death is imminent, I'm not saying don't do an intervention, but I am saying when you see someone slowly destroying themselves with drugs or alcohol or something else, all you can do is be the healthiest you can be, so that hopefully they will look at you and go, why is your life so great? And how do you do it? How do you get through a day? And then you can open up a dialogue with them and say, you know, this is what I do. I mean, you don't want to judge them. Well, I don't take drugs. You don't want to come from that angle, because it's going to drive them away. You just want to make them feel safe around you and let them know that you're a non-judgmental, healthy friend, and when they're ready, you're there for them. Now, that doesn't mean you become an enabler. That doesn't mean when, for example, Jill, your father calls you and says, I don't know what to do. Can you come over and tell your mom not to do this to me? I mean, you don't want to take over his own responsibilities for honoring himself. That's something you don't want to do. That's enabling. I'll take over your responsibilities for honoring yourself. I'll take over your values and I'll take over your life so that you don't have to do anything. That's not self-empowerment. That's giving them a fish, not teaching them to fish. It's totally different. This can be hard. This is a hard road to travel, because you see people that you really love, that you really appreciate having in your life, you see them going downhill. And it saddens me to see this happen to close family members of mine. When they go downhill and you know that there's a better life for them if they just do these certain things, but they can't until they're ready. They can't until they do either hit rock bottom or they have some sort of enlightening moment that shakes them up so that they have to do something different. But that is usually self-initiated. It's usually something that they discover or that happens to them that's just so powerful. And it just needs to happen to them instead of someone coming up to them and saying, this is what you need to do. Or like I did, I can help you, Mom. Move out, I'll help you. No matter what the best solution is, and you could give them the golden ticket out of their situation, and they still won't take it. And we just have to let that responsibility go. So your question is, at what point do you stop being responsible for your family members? Today. You just have to. And if you feel any guilt about it, then be a better you. Improve yourself. Be the best you can be. It doesn't mean you don't check in. I mean, you can check in and you can call and how are things going, but never bring up, are you going to leave? You know, don't bring up the stuff that they're not deciding for themselves yet, because they're going to bring it up. I'm ready to leave. When your father says, I'm ready to leave, what do I need to do? Do you have any idea? I mean, that's when they ask for help. I mean, when they ask for help, absolutely step in full force, 100%. I'm there. That's what I would do. If my mom ever called me up and says, I am ready to leave this relationship, I would be like, I will find the next flight there. That's what I would do. And, you know, she's out of that relationship now. But before, when she was in that relationship, if she said that and she called out to me for help, I was there. And she knew it. She knew I was there for her. But she would have had to have come to that place in herself before she reached out to me. Fortunately, he left her and it all is still working itself out, but it's a lot better than it used to be because he's no longer living there. So that's good. As for your situation, just keep being a better you. Just keep showing up as yourself. Try not to judge. Try not to control. Try not to be someone else's mentor unless they want you to be. Try not to be someone else's guide out of a situation unless they want you to be. When they reach out for help, when they are ready to take action and look to you to take that action, step in full force. Go for it. They may be scared, but that's why it's good to be a healthy, confident you. So you can bring this confident you into the situation saying, don't worry. We'll tackle anything that comes along. You don't have to worry about a thing. That would feel pretty good to someone who's scared to move, but they're going to move anyway. Great. So I hope this information helps. Like I said, it's very hard. It's a very difficult situation because we love our family. A lot of us do. And we want to do everything we can to see them through. And, you know, this doesn't apply to young children. If you're taking care of young children, you just have to be the disciplinarian sometimes, the authority, to make sure that they don't get into trouble. At the same time, you don't want to be overbearing and over-authoritative and overly restrictive because that usually causes them to rebel. But, you know, with children, that's a whole nother episode for a whole nother day. And no matter what I say, they're going to do the opposite. So we'll talk about that some other time. But for the other adults in your life, for your sisters, for your parents, for your cousins and other relatives, just be you, just be there. And when they're ready, they'll reach out. They'll know who the stable people are in their life, and they'll seek you out. You have challenges ahead because you'll see things that you know that people can do better, but you have to be stronger in yourself so that they see that strength and they know where to get it when they're ready. I hope this helps, Jill. Thank you so much for writing. And thanks for listening to this episode of The Overwhelmed Brain. When we come back, we'll thank a few people. I'll give you some final thoughts, then we'll close the show. Be right back. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Overwhelmed Brain. I want to thank Asha with GetOutOfTheMess.com. She has the amazing ability to connect you with the freedom to be comfortable no matter what life sends your way. That might be an overstatement. But if you're in the US or Canada and you have some legal issue you want to deal with, or you want to make it a legal issue, visit GetOutOfTheMess.com or call 678-355-8777 and talk with Asha today. And I want to thank those who are using the Amazon link on theoverwhelmedbrain.com. When you shop using the Amazon link, and Christmas is coming, when you shop using that link, Amazon sends us pennies on the dollar for everything that you purchase there. And it does help with everything that we do on this show. And in fact, while you're using the Amazon link, why not pick up a book called The Overwhelmed Brain? This is a physical book that you can hold in your hand. It is the A to Z of empowerment. So I encourage you, if it's not for you, if you're already empowered, pick it up anyway or give it as a gift to someone in your life that you think could use it. Get The Overwhelmed Brain in a paper book fashion, not an ebook. Well, it will be a Kindle book too, but it's also a book you can carry around with you with a yellow highlighter or a pencil or however you take notes in a book. You can find it at Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com or just go to my website, TheOverwhelmedBrain.com, and you'll find it there too. And I want to thank the people who left reviews in iTunes. I just read a couple more, and they are glowing. They are so kind, and I feel so honored when I read those. And I haven't seen any scathing reviews lately, but if they come, I promise to read them on the air. But so far, so good. So thank you for your reviews. And finally, thank you to Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com for some of the music transitions in The Overwhelmed Brain. I'd like to close the show talking about getting together with friends and family over the holidays. Yes, isn't it nice? Isn't it nice to get together with friends and family over the holidays? Well, yes, but not all of us do that. Some of us don't have friends and family to get together with. I remember when my wife left, I had no one on my birthday, and then I had no one on Thanksgiving. And then I had no one. I mean, I was alone. I was literally alone because I knew very few people in Portland, and those that I knew, I certainly wasn't close friends with. They were work friends, and they had their own thing going on. So, I wasn't invited to anywhere by anyone. So I spent those holidays. I spent Christmas alone, spent New Year's alone. And, that's not the first time I've done that, but that's happened to me in the past. Sometimes we're just alone during these special events when we're supposed to be with family and friends. And that's no fun. And I get it. So maybe we'll visit social media and find out how everyone's doing, and then we'll see that they're with their families. But what do you do when you're alone? Does it affect you? Is it sad? I remember when I was alone during the holiday, it didn't really matter to me if it was the holiday or not, because I was alone the day before, and I was alone the day after. And so, where do you go when you're alone? What do you do? Well, this is the most important time for self-nurturing. Self-nurturing is when you treat yourself as your own best friend, or the best father you never had, the best mother you never had, or maybe you did have the best father or mother and they're not around, or you can't be with them, but you do some self-nurturing. And all that means is if you would go out to a movie with your best friend, then make yourself your best friend and go out to that movie, damn it. If you would eat a grand turkey dinner with your family and your family's not around, then make yourself a grand turkey dinner and eat it. I know, it's so easy to talk about, right? It's so easy for me to just say that. Sometimes you just want to feel alone. Sometimes you want to own that loneliness, that place, because you're not ready to self-nurture, or it feels weird, or something. So what else can you do? There's a million things that I could talk about here. You know, go to the homeless shelter and start feeding the homeless people. You know what? That's not a bad idea, because I remember when my wife and I were homeless. I mean, we weren't living on the street, fortunately, but we had nothing else. And we went to the homeless shelter every day. Go to the food kitchen and serve homeless people. How about that? That may not be up your alley, but I tell you what, when I was married, we were so grateful to have a food shelter serve us on Thanksgiving and Christmas. We were so grateful. In fact, I remember they dressed up the soup kitchen with all these colorful lights, and it did feel festive. I think about those days today and go, wow, look at where we were at that time and being grateful to be in line at 6 a.m. at a soup kitchen. So grateful for those times. And, you know, there were so many people. There were families there. We were together, but we were still two adults. There were adults there with children. And we could look at those people and realize how lucky we were. We didn't have children in this mix, but, you know, people that had children probably had it a lot harder than we did. So I can look back and feel grateful for the people who volunteered their time at a soup kitchen to feed me. That just feels so amazing to me. So, I mean, that's a choice for you. You don't have to go to a soup kitchen. You can go to a meetup. You can go to someplace like, I don't know if you have this in your area. It's called nextdoor.com, N-E-X-T-D-O-O-R. They don't know I'm talking about them, but it's a resource that I use that you can connect with your neighbors. It's a little bit more local than just connecting through Facebook. But you can find out events, and you can put messages out there to your direct neighbors. We're talking about in your neighborhood. It's a neat service. I don't know where they do it. I don't know if it's just the U.S. or outside the U.S., but check it out, nextdoor.com. That's a good way to connect with people. So if you don't want to be alone, you can put a message out there that says, and you could do this through Facebook too, put a message out there that says, hey, I'm spending the holiday alone. Anyone want to connect? or not. I mean, these are just suggestions. You could certainly listen to every single episode that I created and you won't be alone on the holiday. Because I have over, 170 episodes now. Hey, just listen to me talk the whole time. But I am here for you when you're ready to listen to another episode. And let me just say this one last thing about being alone during the time when everyone else is with their family. It's nice when family or friends bring a gift and say, hey, we got this for you. That feels good. But it also feels good to give. It's also nice to show up, maybe at your neighbor's house, maybe at a coworker's house, and say, hey, I got this gift for you. That's a nice feeling too. If you're alone and you don't want to feel alone, maybe you can do something like that. It's a neat way to connect, and it's a good way to show others that you care, and maybe you'll just find someone who just happens to be alone too, and maybe there'll be some good conversation that goes on from there. I don't know. But I want you to feel good during the festivities and when people are with friends and family, and maybe you're not, or maybe you are, and maybe when you're with friends and family, you feel alone still. How often does that happen when you're with a group of people and you still feel alone? Well, I don't want you to feel alone. Remember that you also have a part of yourself that can nurture you. You also have some of the suggestions that I gave you, and that's the most practical I talk. I never give you like very specific things that you could do, but hey, maybe it'll help. Consider that my intervention. So I want you to take that and open your mind, because with an open mind, you might do some of this stuff, and that'll help you step into your power and be firm in your decisions and actions so that you can create the life you want. Always take steps to grow and evolve. You are powerful beyond measure. And above all, and this is something I absolutely know to be true about you, you are amazing.